This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. Question: where do some traditions come from that seem so barbaric and frustrating in the 21st century? How can they be changed? Why are they so resistant to change? This hour, we'll look at some of these traditions that may have seemed innocent once, but are anything but now. Everything from name changes of sports teams. A community in northeastern Florida is trying to change the name of a local high school named after a former KKK leader, to the more frustrating challenge of changing the ways women are taught to have no self-esteem or self-respect in India.
There is violence everywhere, whether at home or outside on the road. Rape and sexual assault is a way of life in India.
A way of life that produces a mindset that has to be changed one person, one girl victim, one intolerant man or boy at a time. That conversation later this hour. And hey, folks, you'll have to find another way to be kind than rewinding videotapes. Blockbuster is finally closing its remaining doors. But we begin this hour with a look at a set of traditions within the NFL that may permit a level of violence and tension that has seriously disrupted a team this week. Jonathan Martin, second-year offensive lineman with the Miami Dolphins, has reportedly left the team after allegedly enduring repeated incidents of harassment and bullying by teammates. Martin was reportedly not the only victim. Richie Incognito, a 9-year veteran and Martin's line mate, has been described as the source of the harassment and has been indefinitely suspended by the Dolphins after reports which included, thus far reported, making Martin pay huge dinner and bar bills accrued by older teammates on nights out, including a $15,000 trip to Las Vegas, and voicemails and texts that verbally threatened Martin and his family, sometimes with racially inflammatory language.
You know what, I'm just trying to weather the storm right now, and this will pass.
You know, there's an allegation that you left these voicemails on Jonathan Martin's voicemail. What do you have to say about those?
You know, no comment right now. We're just going to kind of weather the storm, and that's it.
That's Richie Incognito speaking to Miami's WSVN. Incognito has denied that the incidents are serious, but other reports say he may have been specifically ordered to have toughened up Martin by the coaching staff, although teammates yesterday had nothing to say about those reports.
Does he like to give guys a hard time? Yes. Does he like to pester guys and have fun? Yes. But he brought a lot of laughter to this locker room. He brought a lot of cohesiveness to this locker room. And he was the best teammate that I could ask for.
I never thought it was a death threat. I never thought he was actually going to do the things he said. And if you can't take validity from one part of the voicemail, how can you take validity from the whole part? You know, you can't pick and choose which parts count, which parts don't count.
At the very least, this is a huge distraction for the Miami Dolphins team members and coaching staff in the middle of the season. But joining us to talk about the culture of the NFL locker room is Wade Davis, retired NFL player. Wade, welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Great. How do you evaluate what's going on here? Is there any sort of rule, kind of fraternity, sort of hazing idea, subculture that you could respond to here and give us some context?
Well, to be honest, you know, I had the privilege of being on 5 different NFL teams, 2 in NFL Europe. And, you know, to be honest, there are things that go on in the NFL locker room that a person from the outside looking in may not understand. You know, I'm sure if I took a group of anyone's friends and I was an outsider and I saw the way that they interacted and the language that they may use, you know, I may say, hey, that's inappropriate. But I think that we have to be really mindful of context, you know, and I'm 100% behind a Jonathan Martin and think that some of the language that Richie Incognito used went above and beyond what people who are in a workplace environment and or friends should basically use. But I just want to be mindful that that context matters and that the way that I may interact with my 3 sisters, you know, someone else may say, hey, like, I don't really appreciate the way that his sisters are talking to him and vice versa. So I just don't want the NFL or whether it's fraternities or whether it's the workplace on Wall Street, you know, to get a bad rap when context really does matter.
Although, do you think it is a working environment that's tough? I mean, do you hear the N-word all the time? Are there references to being gay as a pejorative that just gets thrown around in a way that would be utterly shocking in any other workplace?
I think that there is language that's used that may not be, you know, conducive to other working environments, but sports teams are not your typical work environment. You know, I'm an openly gay male, and I never felt bullied or harassed. Granted, I wasn't out while I was playing, but even while I was playing in the NFL, I never heard homophobic language used. Now, I'll be honest that there is other language that someone may deem sexist and or have issues around race. But it's an environment that is very different. And you have to come into that environment knowing what you're getting into. You know, the same environment that existed in the NFL also was very, very similar in college. It was very, very similar in high school.
All right, Wade. So I'm, you know, I'm a veteran on the team. You're picking up the tab at this dinner for, you know, $6,000. Does that ever happen to you?
Well, yes, there is a system, right? So when you're a rookie, that you take out your veteran players, but also players know how much you make, you know. So I was a free agent, you know, I was making the league minimum. So what I had to pay was a couple hundred bucks, or it was getting some veterans coffee or donuts. You know, if you're a first round draft pick, you know, maybe your tab is $5,000.
All right. Yeah, I get it. It's sort of the pecking order kind of thing. Finally, Jonathan Martin seems to have walked away from a lifelong dream to be in the NFL. I think you can probably respond to that because of your time and your dream to make it in the NFL. Something big happened here, yes?
You know, there was a guy for the Denver Broncos who just popped up and quit. You know, there are many reasons why guys choose to not play a sport anymore. I think that whatever happened in Miami definitely spawned Mr. Martin to stop playing. But I think as more of the information gets out, we'll find out that there was a potential that he felt this way long before some of these issues were happening.
Tough decisions, that's for sure. Wade Davis, retired NFL player. Thanks so much, Wade.
No problem.
Another test coming in the U.S. Senate. The widely supported International United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities is once again before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The Obama administration supports passage of the act. The original impetus was to extend protections already enacted in law in the United States in the Americans with Disabilities Act into a worldwide treaty. But here in the U.S., the convention has been a rallying cry for conservatives who believe it will be used to give the U.N. legal authority over Congress. Is this about conservative principles or just an obstructionist Congress determined to derail something that has majority support in the world and represents fairness for people with disabilities? As someone with a disability myself, it's hard to be objective here or really argue against something that would extend benefits that have tangibly improved my life, extend them to the world at large. So I turn to my disabled colleague and fellow wheelchair user, Judith Heumann. She's the Special Advisor for International Disability Rights at the U.S. State Department. She says there's a delicate lobbying process at work in the Senate right now.
I would like to look at this convention as a work in progress and not to think that it's a pawn. I believe very much that people are looking to a way to get to supporting the treaty, which is what the administration is trying to do, is to help us work together with the civil society and with the members, Republicans and Democrats, to be able to address amendments that will help satisfy both parties. You and I know, John, as disabled people who travel, the numbers of problems that we have, both in just daily professional traveling that we need to do, but for individuals, veterans, disabled veterans, and civilians with disabilities who in our ever-globalizing world are looking to be able to travel abroad, to study abroad, to work abroad, we must be able to look at ways to advance the work that we've done in the United States to assist other governments and civil society to more clearly understand what we've done, how we've done it, and to work with them to adopt similar laws and implementation.
One of the huge ironies here is that the convention is really based on the gold standard of disability rights advocacy in the United States and the Americans with Disabilities Act, yet opponents are calling this some sort of United Nations imposed world government restriction on U.S. law.
Yes, I mean, there certainly are members of the Senate who do not support ratification of treaties. What I'd like your listeners to understand is when the Americans with Disabilities Act came into force in 1990, that was the result of thousands of disabled people in the United States giving testimony to the types of discrimination that they were experiencing with House of Representative members and senators, so that people could understand that this was not isolated and that we needed a national law. If we think about this in the context of the development of the Disabilities Treaty, the UN was a convening place. So disabled people came from all around the world for a number of years to talk with their representatives from their governments to the United Nations and to be able to clearly explain the kinds of problems that people were facing in their countries, very similar to ours. People may want to look at the op-ed piece that Senator Frist had out on Reuters, where he very clearly articulates in the beginning of his piece a deaf person who is at a hospital who is unable to communicate with the people in the hospital because they had no sign language interpreters. And he had a piece of paper and he wrote plus. And plus meant that he was HIV positive. So he was trying to get services, but he was unable to get services. So I think we are seeing that people like Senator Frist, who I, you know, is a Republican and a conservative, but has been very supportive of the Americans with Disabilities Act, is very supportive of this treaty because he believes, as do many others, that we want to use the gold standard of the United States to help improve quality of life for people overseas. This is an anti-discrimination provision. It basically says in the United States, healthcare services that are provided for non-disabled individuals must be provided for disabled individuals, but that's already covered in the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ratification of the Disabilities Treaty by the United States will require no new legislation. It will require no additional dollars. Why do we think it's important? Because we want to enable disabled people in the U.S. to have greater opportunities to study, work, live abroad, and we want to use our knowledge and experience to be able to assist governments and civil society in other countries to make similar advancements over the next decade and so.
Judy Heumann, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John.
Judy Heumann is the Special Advisor for International Disability Rights at the U.S. State Department. The power and politics of naming later this hour. Teams, streets, buildings across the country have names some find offensive. Does a name change matter? McKinney, Texas, one of you says, actions speak louder than words. If the institution has progressed beyond any negative connotations of the name, what does the name matter? Do you think Americans are too easily offended? Give us your view by visiting thetakeaway.org. Click on today's show to take a quick online poll on offensive names and what should be done about them. The raised profile of people with disabilities involves a changing mindset that is a consequence of legal battles, as we've just described, and successful individuals who push into wide public attention. My kids discovered this very unscientific list of, quote, 10 majorly successful people with disabilities published last month on the Huffington Post. Physicist Stephen Hawking with ALS, he uses a wheelchair, was at the top. FDR, U.S. president with polio and a wheelchair user, was number two. Number three was a guy famous for making vehicles anyone can drive, Ralph Braun. And I, shockingly, am at number four, preceding deaf actress Marlee Matlin and blind Stevie Wonder. This particularly impressed my kids. Helen Keller came in at eight, which made my wife say, that list is bogus. Now, if they had included athletes, probably all 10 on the list would certainly be Olympic or Paralympians. Amputee runner Oscar Pistorius would certainly be there, but for his murder trial and all his troubles. But on Sunday, Tatiana McFadden became the first athlete to complete a marathon grand slam after winning races in Boston, London, Chicago, and New York all in the same year. Never been done by anyone. Now this very majorly accomplished wheelchair user is focusing on the Sochi Winter Paralympic Games. Tatiana, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So are you feeling a little high profile these days with your success?
I don't know if I would be feeling high profile. I'm actually just catching up on school. I'm finishing up my senior year, so I've been quite busy and making up quizzes and exams. And so hopefully I'll have time to enjoy my time this weekend.
Describe the reaction of crowds in the marathons that you've competed in, because there's a particular reaction, especially when someone is known and is really leading the pack.
You know, just having the support from the crowds is quite amazing because, you know, every athlete, every runner hits a runner's block. And for me, you know, I hit that after mile 15, you know, after that 2 mile climb up the bridge. And you just want to know when the race is over. You're exhausted. You're out of breath. Your muscles hurt. You ache. And so just having the support from the crowds and people cheering my name was quite amazing. And it just sort of just uplifted, you know, you uplifted your spirits and you forgot how tired you are. You could say, I love this. I can keep going. And so just having the support from the crowd is fantastic.
And your time, 1:59:39, how did you feel about that?
You know, I felt okay about it because it was quite windy. You know, it was 15 mile per hour headwinds, straight headwind. And so, you know, we were crossing the bridge and I just felt my front end just shaking back and forth as I was climbing. And so, you know, just to sneak it in, you know, slightly under 2 hours, I'm happy with it.
Well, when the wind's against you, you definitely can feel it, whether you're running or pushing a wheelchair. What do you think it takes for Paralympian athletes to emerge and be recognized as legitimate athletes who are doing things that push the human body in ways that are universally accepted and amazing?
You know, it's just I'm just like any other elite athlete. You know, I push my body to the limits. I train twice a day. You know, I lift 170 pounds. And so a lot of my training are, you know, just like any elite Olympic, Paralympic athlete, except for we use our upper body. And so it's amazing that, you know, we are being recognized by the media, that I'm honored and humbled that, you know, there's stories wanting to be, you know, written about Paralympic athletes, because I think it really pushes and excels the sports. You know, in the Paralympic Games, they outsold the Olympic tickets, and that goes to show that people want to see Paralympic athletes. They're interested, and it excites the public.
And your paralysis comes from being born with spina bifida, right?
Correct. Born with spina bifida.
Right. Now, you know, the idea that you could have a successful life was a bit of a question mark when you were born, maybe more of a question mark 20 years before that. A lot has changed over the last 40 years for people with disabilities. What do you think is a more important driver of that change? Successes of people like you, or legal changes in Washington, like the Convention on Rights with People for Disabilities and the Americans with Disabilities Act?
You know, I think it takes a mixture of those, because when I was in high school, I had to file a lawsuit against Howard County, suing for no money, no damages, but just for the right for physically disabled athletes to participate in high school sports. So I think it takes a person who is dedicated, you know, who wants to push for the rights. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be an athlete, but, you know, it just takes it's a lot of hard work. And, you know, people will be upset and they might not understand the change. But, you know, it's going through that in high school. You know, it just takes a lot of strong will. And that's where it starts, is the younger generation, and teaching that younger generation, teaching them that we are just like everybody else. And so I think it just takes a mixture.
And for someone who runs the New York Marathon in under 2 hours, when you encounter someone who says, no, you can't get in here, sorry, we don't have a entrance, what's your reaction to that kind of discrimination or being told you can't do something?
I mean, in my vocabulary, there's no such thing as can't. I probably will find a way to get in. Because having a physical disability, I live life just like anybody else. I've traveled the world. I've won Paralympic medals, and I'm graduating college, you know, with a degree. And I've done so much in my lifetime, and it really is about educating society. And
you're just getting started, that's for sure. Let's talk about the Winter Olympics before we go. What's your event in the Winter Olympics?
My event is cross-country skiing. I'll do the sprint, 5K, and the 10K, and the biathlon.
And for the American team, even though you were born in Russia?
For the American team, yes.
Wow. So you'll be ruffling some feathers over there in Sochi.
I think it's good to go back and just show a living success story of being adopted by an American family. And, I think it's going to be a huge Paralympic movement for Russia. And so that's also fantastic.
Tatiana McFadden is 24 years old, winner of the London, Chicago, Boston, and New York wheelchair marathons, winner of 10 Paralympic medals, and training for the 2014 Winter Paralympics in cross-country skiing. Tatiana, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
America fought a bloody war over a mindset about slavery and race, a war that continued long after the surrender of the Confederacy. Jacksonville, Florida is named after Andrew Jackson, famous for fighting Native Americans. And Jacksonville's Nathan B. Forrest High School is named for someone famous for fighting Northerners during the Civil War. The school opened in 1959, just a few years after the Supreme Court ruled against segregated schools in the 1954 decision Brown versus Board of Ed. In a deliberate reaction to that, the school was named for Forrest, who, besides being a Confederate general, was also the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan.
Our children and our city deserve better than to have a school named after this immoral man. He had no connection with our city, and his name was placed on the school out of spite.
That's Opio Soconi, president of the Jacksonville Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He's one of more than 100,000 people who have signed a petition to change the name of Forrest High School. Joining us now from Jacksonville is Karen Fagans, reporting for WJCT. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
What are the arguments against changing it? What's the sense of tradition here? And how does it differ from, say, the debates over the use of the Confederate flag, which has caused considerable controversy in the South in a different context?
Well, there are a couple of different arguments. One of them is that General Forrest wasn't the bad person that modern critics make him out to be. The other arguments are that there are other things the school board should be focused on. And then there are some people who just feel that it's tradition.
Has it inflamed a sense of division within the community, black versus white?
It's not so much a black versus white issue. There were people who spoke at the school board meeting the other night who were black, who were not fighting for the name change. It has become divisive for the people who are really passionate about this issue. When you look back to 1959, you'll have speakers who remember when the name was chosen, and they say that this name was specifically chosen as a reaction to desegregation. So the name Forrest was brought to the board by the Daughters of the American Confederacy, and they proposed that name as a way to say, okay, look, if you're going to desegregate our schools, then we'll name a school after a Confederate general and the Grand Wizard of the KKK.
So this was a debate that was engaged almost from the beginning. Let's hear a voice from one of the individuals that resists changing the name. Tell me a little bit about Barbie Langdon Ratliff. Here she is. She's a 1976 Forrest High graduate.
We'll never know everything about Mr. Forrest, but his speeches that I've read and the attendance of his funeral by hundreds of African Americans lead me to believe that he was not the racist monster that the media would have us believe that he was.
Is she typical?
Yes, quite a few people have that argument. And they say they've read the history about Forrest and that, yes, he started the KKK, but as soon as it became that type of organization, that he no longer wanted to be a part of it.
Is it impossible, as history proceeds and we get farther and farther away from the events, that if the name stays the same, it essentially makes the argument that not everyone in the KKK was bad?
I suppose that could be the case. There are so many people right now. I feel like there is real momentum for the first time to actually change the name. I covered this 6 years ago, and at the time, it was a very different feeling. And of course, the board ultimately voted on racial lines to keep the name the same. It doesn't feel that way this time. There's a new superintendent who says he supports the name change. He came here from Miami. He worked for the state of Florida. And he said before he even was here, he was curious about this name and thought it was kind of strange. And he doesn't like that when people ask him about our school district, they ask about the name of this school instead of about the other great things that are going on in the Duval County school system. So I think there's a feeling now that regardless of why it was named or who Nathan B. Forrest really was, that maybe it just sends the wrong message to have that name on a school in Jacksonville.
Karen Fagans is Director of Programming and News for WJCT in Jacksonville, Florida. Karen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This next story is not a surprise, really. Perhaps in your neighborhood, you haven't missed the Friday night brightly lit Blockbuster store, its full parking lot, microwave popcorn bin, and big boxes of Milk Duds. Well, the last 300 stores are closing down early next year, we learned this week. The whole business model in flames, from Netflix, on-demand streaming, iTunes, and video archives that easily store in the cloud. Back in 2004, Blockbuster had more than 9,000 stores with 60,000 employees. Thousands more folks worked in the independent video rental businesses. Quentin Tarantino worked at Video Archives in Manhattan Beach, California, before becoming Quentin Tarantino the Legend. We think of him as a legend. Aaron Hillis once wore the Blockbuster brand as a helpful blue-shirted clerk. Today, he's a film critic and owns Video Free Brooklyn. Welcome, Aaron.
Thank you.
Not exactly the Quentin Tarantino trajectory, but you've done fine for yourself.
I can't complain, that's for sure.
How much was Blockbuster a competitor with independents going back to the days when you were actually a clerk there?
Oh, quite a lot. I mean, you know, when Blockbuster, when I was first aware of them, you know, probably mid-late 80s, you know, but Blockbuster, I was vaguely aware that they were starting to kind of take over, and that some of the mom and pop shops were going under because they couldn't compete with these supersized stores.
Part of the problem that Blockbuster had that they tried to address was the lack of you know, film buff clerks who really understood movie recommendations and really knew how to do in personal relationships what Netflix now does with an algorithm, and that is, oh, you'd love this.
Yeah, I never, you know, a lot of my cinephilia comes from the discovery from video stores, and I certainly never got that from Blockbuster. I mean, you know, I had to know what I was looking for, and typically, you know, it was really more for like the big Hollywood fair, because they would have, you know, 100 copies of it.
And cinephilia, that's what you describe your obsession?
Yeah, I mean, I'm so passionate about film. It sounds like a sickness. It probably
yeah,
is.
It does sound like a sickness. Well, give me a recommendation or tell me a story of a recommendation you gave to someone that was particularly successful.
I was very excited. I actually did this past week. Three teenage girls came into the store, and they were renting like some Zac Efron movies. And we had a special where they were able to get one more movie. And I can tell they were really having trouble finding something and agreeing on something. And that I ended up giving them Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains, which is about three teenage girls who start a punk rock band. And I'd like to think it's going to change their lives forever.
And they haven't brought it back yet, though, right?
They haven't, but as soon as I told them that, they got really excited, and I think they were about to give up on Zac Efron altogether.
So your feeling about Blockbuster is maybe a little good riddance here. I'm wondering if you could comment on what the role of independent video rental stores is going to be going forward.
Well, I mean, I have to admit, when I first heard the news, I thought, really? They're still around? I really didn't know. I mean, I know that models are changing and people watch movies in so many different ways these days in the, you know, the post-internet and even post-Netflix age. But for us, we're more of a boutique, and it's really about curation. I typically compare it to the vinyl store resurgence. So I don't know if there's really a sustainable model for everybody, but it certainly works for us in media savvy Brooklyn.
And, you know, do you have a final thought for Blockbuster? Some sort of cinephiliac kind of, in a world where people get their movies from the cloud.
I'll say this: you know, ultimately, good riddance. I don't think there's a reason it was a dinosaur of a model, and I just don't think that they really catered or cared about film culture, and I don't think that they were doing anything to really help you know, spawn new cinephiles, more diseased people like myself.
Well, they made a lot of you know, medium sized box retail spaces that I presume now are like Rite Aids and Walgreens, don't you think?
A lot of just things left behind, littering the landscape.
Well, that's healthy for us anyway, pharmacies. Aaron Hillis, owner of Video Free Brooklyn, a video rental store in Cobble Hill. He's also a New York City-based film critic. Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you.
What if no matter what you tried to teach your daughter, the message she got from other members of your own family and the world around her was that she was nothing? She was nobody. This is a common outcome in India, where according to the National Crime Records Bureau in India, a woman there is sexually assaulted every 3 minutes. The expectation of being viewed as a sexual object or as a disappointment over not being born a boy is a massive social problem in India that has not responded to changing laws or even the widely reported gang rape in New Delhi in 2012 and the public trial for the accused that ended in death penalties. To change minds, particularly how young girls think about themselves, is the door-to-door job of a brave team of women in the southern state of Andhra Pradesh. Jamila Nishat runs the Shaheen Resource Center for Women in Hyderabad. Her organization attempts to aid and empower women one by one who are convinced that there is no hope and no future.
So two girls were walking on the road and they saw one woman who was a divorcee who was pregnant, 8-month pregnancy, and she was chewing cotton. And when she was chewing cotton, they asked her, "What happened? Why are you chewing cotton?" And she said, "I'm hungry and I have nothing to eat." Then we called her to Shaheen, we gave her some food, we gave her some money. We said, after delivery, you come back again. And whatever happens, whether it's a girl child or a boy child, you bring the child, we'll take care of the child. But then after 2 months, when the girls went there, they found that she is alone, not having any baby. We asked her what happened. Then she said that her 11-year-old daughter pulled the umbilical cord of the baby and killed the baby, saying that I suffered enough, you suffered enough. Why do you want this young baby to be born and suffer on earth?
Jamila Nishat shuddered when she told us that story of a woman she couldn't ultimately reach to save her baby. But she says all she can do is fight for each young girl, one at a time.
There is violence everywhere, whether at home or outside on the road. Rape and sexual assault is a way of life in India. Any girl faces violence, rape or sexual assault, she can't talk about it at home. She can't talk about it in the public. She can't talk about it at the police. Shame is a big thing for them. So whether it's an acid pouring attack, whether it is sexual attack, any attack, the girls don't talk about it.
And describe the vulnerability of the young women who you speak to, who come to your organization, and you try to intervene and help them.
See, actually, the girls don't come to us. We go to the girls. That's the system we have. Every morning, Shaheen's girls go door to door, talk to the women in the old city. We work in 20 slums, and that's how we interact. There are many, many cases of violence. There's gang rape, incest, and these girls are not very old. They are 7-year-old, 9-year-old. They are raped. When we go to the police, we file a case, it takes hell of a time. One woman, her two daughters were raped. She's still asking for justice and she hasn't got the justice. Justice doesn't happen fast. It's not a speedy justice at all.
When justice is so questionable, where the police are not necessarily even on the side of women, how much courage does it take to go and knock on doors, to basically intervene in something that you may be the only one who cares?
I know. But what to do? We need to work, you know, we need to make them feel the pain that they are living in. They were thinking it's a way of life. Every woman has to suffer like this. This is our fortune, you know. But when we made them realize that you are somebody, you can't believe when we started working, I asked the girls a question, "Who are you?" And the girls answered, "I am nobody."
What a mindset. When you talk about mindset, that's it right there.
That's the main problem. The mindset is the main problem. And many a times when the girls are poured acid on their faces by the boyfriends, the girl feels that there's something wrong with me. The girl never realizes that the other man is wrong. She always feels guilty about herself. And we are bringing them out of that and we are giving them courage and saying that, no, what you are doing is right. You have to be assertive in what you're doing.
How did you shake off this sense of shame, disrespect, the idea that there's no hope? What was the space for you?
See, I'm basically a poet. I created my space in my papa's drawing room. I started reciting my poems to his friends. And that's how I created my own space. And then I was reciting my poems in front of a big, large, huge audience. So I realized that it is your visibility, your confidence, which gives you life. My sisters were also girls, but they were not behaving like me. So I created my space.
And have a strength as a result that you're passing on to other girls.
Yes, yes. My life is, my mission is that. Every girl is my poem, my life. I live with her. Wherever the justice fails, she is with me in my poem. Every girl is in me, and I am in every girl.
Jamila Nishat runs the Shaheen Resource Center for Women in Andhra Pradesh, India. Just for some context, we mentioned how a woman is sexually assaulted every 3 minutes in India. But according to the U.S. Department of Justice's National Crime Victimization Survey, someone in the U.S. is sexually assaulted every 2 minutes. We heard earlier about a school in Florida under fire for its name. Speaking of mindsets and the difficulty of changing them, the name of an original member of the Ku Klux Klan. But what about the Cleveland Indians? Jefferson High School. Hey, Thomas Jefferson was a slave owner. Malcolm X Boulevard. Where do we draw the line when it comes to names? Does a name change matter? Does the change fix and settle history, or does it actually raise issues? Mark Cope wrote us on Facebook. Sometimes it does matter. My high school mascot, the Redskins, was changed because it was an offensive slang, but proper names like the Central Michigan University's Chippewa is appropriate because it honors the tribe and local heritage and should not be changed. Irving, Texas, one of you. Those names are a vestige of the past, and while they are not PC, they are part of a tradition. I'm sure that the people today in the Washington Redskins organization, for example, do not harbor racist feelings toward Native Americans. Next on The Takeaway, we'll talk about the challenges of naming and renaming. It's a political battle. It's about tradition. It's about holding on to old history and embracing new history. Tell us what you think. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. There's much more at thetakeaway.org, including a poll talking about what you should do about a name if you think it should be changed.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Back to the question of names and their sometimes troubled history. Earlier this hour, we looked at a local controversy over the name of a school playing out at Jacksonville, Florida. But that's just one example that might raise questions. Plenty of pro and school teams have used Native American imagery over time. And a lot of those names, like the use of Confederate flags, have been deemed offensive to communities in our time who see all of these symbols and references much differently. Joining us now to talk about the challenge of naming and renaming is Dr. Leah Wright, Professor of History and African American Studies at Wesleyan. Dr. Wright, welcome.
Hi, thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
How complicated are these name changes and the history that they really unsettle when the name suddenly becomes the focus of attention in a community?
So the history behind them is hugely controversial. I think on the one hand, there's definitely a technical aspect to these kinds of things, whereby it can be easy to change names. Sometimes it can be difficult to change names. But I think what's much more problematic and much more difficult to handle is the history surrounding the names and the way in which different communities in the present really grapple and go back and forth over what the names mean and why they should change them. The emotions surrounding name changes are just very, very heated deeply kind of felt by both sides.
Let's look at the Native American imagery in the NFL just for a moment. I mean, you've got on the one hand the Redskin idea, which is very, very racial. It comes out of a time when there was a kind of an honorary sense of remembering Indians and remembering the heroism of them. And there are even teams called the Warriors and the Braves who take it away from the purely racial aspect. And then you've got over in Seattle, the Seahawks, that uses an actual Native American symbol of tribes that still still are active in the Pacific Northwest, as though it's really integrated into the community. There's history and controversy in each one of those approaches, yes?
Right. And I'm glad that you mentioned the Washington Redskins example. I believe in the last few days, a D.C. council actually voted to call upon the Redskins to change their name, citing the derogatory and racist imagery surrounding the Redskins logo and the name, and citing, you know, the history of Native Americans in this country. The owner of the Redskins said, you know, I unequivocally refuse to change the name, and I will not change the name. And I think this brings up a lot of the dramatics surrounding the issue. I mean, the history right there is deeply problematic. Having a mascot of a people really just dismisses the plight or the history or even the struggles that these people have gone through. It is derogatory to have, you know, a Native American imagery as a mascot and say, this is, you know, what stands for our team, and in almost a way that mocks people's history.
Does America's diversity and the fact that there are likely to be communities who are represented by specific groups that are named, you know, as sports teams, mean that in many ways it might be safer in America to stick with, you know, creeks and rivers as a name source?
Well, you know, I think that naming comes out of a tradition, or a lot of naming these mascots come out of a tradition, as I mentioned earlier, of commemoration of certain things, but commemoration from the perspective of outside of the minority's perspective or outside of the subjugated group's perspective. So I think just going forward, it makes much more sense to just avoid taking racial groups or taking ethnic groups and saying this is going to be a mascot. It's much, I think, much more salient, makes much more sense just to avoid that kind of thing altogether.
How come Robert E. Lee actually survives as a plausible figure, even though he was a general, the most famous general of the Confederacy?
Well, you know, I think part of this is part of this myth of the Old South, right, which comes about in the aftermath of the Civil War. How does an entire group of people, an entire culture, deal with a monumental loss? The loss of the Civil War. How do we rebuild our society? How do we come to terms with something like that? And how do we come to terms with an entirely new group of people being integrated into the population and being told that they are now human, and now we have to, you know, deal with them? And so what we start to see is a lot of commemoration. We see a lot of parades, figures, statues, and also myth-making, where people start telling these kind of grandiose stories about what really happened during the Civil War, who were the real heroes, and how those things become repeated time and time and time again, and how they actually become ingrained into society. And I think that's how someone like Lee becomes kind of a hero figure in and remains a human figure, despite the fact that he was a Confederate general.
And of course, Nathan Forrest doesn't necessarily qualify or pass the Robert E. Lee standard. He's also a Confederate general, but because he was the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan up in Jacksonville, they've got a problem.
Right. They've got a huge problem. And I think what's interesting about that is that a lot of these charged emotions that surround the Jacksonville case come out from a particular place where people say, well, you know, Forster wasn't necessarily that kind of a racist, or, you know, it's not about what he did in the Ku Klux Klan, or he may have left it, or the organization didn't stand for those kinds of things, which is also part of this kind of idea of myth making, this idea of taking a narrative and using it to repair a part of the country or region's history. It completely ignores the aspect that actually the Ku Klux Klan does come about not only as a gentleman's club, but as a racist segregationist club designed to exclude and actually target African Americans.
And so when Jacksonville makes a decision to change this name, does the history go away? Is it a controversy that then poof vanishes, or does it live in an undercurrent? And, you know, what's the new name going to be?
Well, I don't even think that it lives in an undercurrent. I think that it actually, it continues. And part of this is because it's built into the culture of a particular area and a place and time. Maybe over many, many years, it'll disappear. Or maybe even in changing the name, it's a step towards kind of reconciling those tense feelings. But there, on both sides of the equation, there are people who have very charged emotion. And there are people who also feel very strongly that the school name should be changed. I don't think that goes away overnight.
Dr. Leah M. Wright is a professor of history and African American studies at Wesleyan University. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks for having me, John.
What's the tipping point? When would you change a name that's grown offensive or has collectively attracted enough offense to make it a political issue in your community? Visit thetakeaway.org and you can click on today's show to take a quick online poll on offensive names. We asked specifically about the Jacksonville case, and 88% of you find it offensive. Do you think Americans are too easily offended, though? From Cocoa, Florida, no, we're not too easily offended. We live in an era where people want to lose offensive stereotypes. Groups feel more empowered now and don't want to be treated like second-class citizens, though, through silly sports teams. Holliston, Massachusetts, we are too easily offended, I would say. Many of those names are historical in nature. At one point, were not offensive. Now, I'm not saying that because something is historical, it mustn't be changed, but the name must be gauged against the larger community that is affected instead of only the most vocal opponents. Thanks so much for listening. We'd love to know what you think. You can call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.